Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In 2011, Jesse Morton was in federal prison on charges to conspire to solicit murder and encouraging violent extremism. He was one of the most prolific American recruiters for Al-Qaeda. His name then was Yunus Abdullah Mohammed. But at night in prison, his jihadi zeal wavered. Morton said he would dream that he was sitting across from Osama bin Laden. Am I becoming a disbeliever? He would ask the Al-Qaeda mastermind. But in his dream, bin Laden would have nothing to say. Well, during that time, from 2011 to 2015, Morton says he was de-radicalized. He became an FBI informant and is now a fellow at the George Washington University Program on Extremism, where he's studying ways to combat the violent ideology he once embraced, embodied, and spread around the world. Jesse Morton joins us now from Washington to tell us his story. Jesse Morton, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
It's really great to have you. Your story is so absolutely fascinating, and the arc of it is unique, and I just hope you might do us the favor of spending some time telling it to us in detail, and just start at the beginning. I mean, how old were you when you were first introduced to Islam?
Well, I was introduced to Islam after a very tumultuous childhood. At the age of 16, due to child abuse in the home, I sort of took to the streets. And I started out in New York City with a rejection of the society around me due to the fact that when I would go to people in my community and ask for assistance with regard to the beatings that were going on in the home, I perceived their intervention as not being satisfactory. And so I adopted a very fearful view of the society around me and mistrusted it.
Can I just jump in here? Not satisfactory, why?
Well, I went to a guidance counselor, for example, and showed him bite marks on myself, and there was no intervention. They called my mother into the school, who was the abuser, and she simply said that my brother and I got in a fight over the weekend, and instantaneously the situation was dropped from discussion. I would go to family members, and they would certainly try to hide the abuse for fear that there would be some ramifications for my mother. I would tell other people in society from time to time when I felt as if I was going to break. And so at a very micro level, I developed a mistrust and then projected that mistrust onto American society as a whole, if you will. So I was looking for an alternative worldview to believe in from a very young age.
Well, it sounds like at a young age you felt like you had been obviously deeply abused by your mother and then let down by the very figures of support and authority. I mean, you're talking about officials at school who were supposed to have helped look after you.
Yes. And I think it's important to talk a lot about what an individual goes through in a pre-radicalization stage of experience, because I do think that there are significant events that we oftentimes identify with when we review the cases of individuals that go on to commit acts of terrorism or that, like myself, become propagandists. We can see a lot of the causal factors in the background, and I believe that my story has to start there because of the significant impact it had on who I became, though I do not in any way, shape, or form today attribute blame to the childhood that I had.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that more in a minute, but it sounds like, I mean, what you're saying is that from a young age you were looking for support, something to believe in, a place to belong. How is it that it came to be, you know, radical Islam that was that place?
Well, I gravitated towards radical ideologies from a very young age, particularly after I ran away. I found myself on the streets trying to fend for myself, but I also found myself in public libraries reading a lot of books, radical leftists particularly, and became politicized. At the same time, I started traveling with a rock and roll band, The Grateful Dead, at one point, and found a new community there, a countercultural movement that I could identify with, that seemed like a substitute for a family I never had. Unfortunately, along with that lifestyle comes criminal behavior, comes drug use, alcohol use, etc. And I continued to, I believe today, I could honestly say that it was an effort to destroy myself, to tear myself down, and to kill off the person that I was born as, Jesse Morton. So when I found Islam, it appealed to me because the first contact I had with Islam was the autobiography of Malcolm X. And in reading the autobiography of Malcolm X, I found an individual that almost was a symbol for what I had experienced. He had a very traumatic experience as a child, went on to engage in criminal behavior, and then transformed his life through the adoption of a new worldview and a religion. When I got to the final chapter of that book and he talked about how he had gone to Mecca in Saudi Arabia and had circumambulated the Kaaba and found that there were white, blue-eyed people alongside of him, I found that the religion of Islam was very intriguing. And so I started to read a lot about it and ultimately converted some months later in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Of course, I didn't transform myself overnight. Found myself incarcerated a few days after converting to Islam in Richmond City Jail in Virginia. And it was there that I was radicalized and introduced to the politicized interpretation of Islam at the hands of a Moroccan who was incarcerated there. And he taught me...
I think you're about to say what I was going to ask, but what exactly did he say that then radicalized you?
Well, I mean, it was a process. So yeah. I had to learn the tenets of my faith. And after I completed learning how to pray in Arabic, he said that now I was actually ready to enter Islam, that until I knew how to pray, I couldn't truly be a Muslim. So he told me to go to the jailhouse shower and to wash every inch of my body and to imagine that I was cleansing myself of everything I had done up until that point. And that sort of felt comfortable for me because it was a way, like I said earlier, about destroying myself. Immediately as I came out and he gave me my Muslim name, Yunus Abdullah Muhammad, I was reborn and offered an opportunity to sort of become an entirely new person. Over the course of some time in there, I remember a significant event that stood out where the politicized interpretation of Islam really started to occur. There was an individual that walked in front of our prayer. He was sort of anti-Islamic. And there's a hadith by the Prophet Muhammad that says that if someone walks in front of your prayer, try to remove him from the way. And if he doesn't step aside, then get up and fight him, for verily he's a devil. He followed that hadith literally and got jumped up because the individual wouldn't move and fought him. He got beat up and he was sort of humiliated. But he called me to the back of his cell and he proceeded to tell me that there would be a perpetual war between Muslims and non-Muslims that would last until the Day of Judgment. And that the reason that it was so important to understand this was because, as another statement attributed to the Prophet Muhammad says, there will be a black flag, the black flag that we see, you know, promoted today by ISIS, that will be raised in Khorasan, which is interpreted by the jihadists as Afghanistan, and it will not be stopped until it reaches Jerusalem. So he was able to attach that message to a lot of political circumstances. At the time, the Taliban, it was previous to 9/11, the Taliban had established a Islamic State in Afghanistan, and I already knew much about the Palestinian-Israeli issue, and from a very far leftist perspective and persuasion due to my politicization before Islam. So it really much resonated with me. And he went into a lot of the millenarian or the apocalyptic statements yeah. that are in the Islamic tradition.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, So clearly you were transformed by this prison experience in, what, 1999 or
approaching
2000? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when you got out of prison in Virginia, I mean, you were a changed man. You were Yunus Abdullah Muhammad. I see that you went to Metropolitan College of New York, graduated as valedictorian, then went to Columbia, got a master's degree. How did that person then go on to be one of the founders of this online presence revolution Muslim, a place where later on some intense recruiting of would-be and actual, you know, violent jihadis went on? How did you end up doing that?
Well, Islam is a very amazing form of spirituality. Some of the Islam has five chief tenets. One is that you declare that you believe in Muhammad and that God is one, a monotheistic religion. And then you must pray five times a day and you fast during the month of Ramadan and you have to give a percentage of your wealth. So Islam gave me structure where there previously was none. And because I was always an articulate and semi-intelligent individual, I was able to succeed at levels that I never was successful at before. So I got a scholarship to Metropolitan College of New York, as you stated. At the same time, I was still radicalizing. I was living in Harlem in a homeless shelter that was run by members, former members of the Nation of Islam, Malcolm X's original movement. And I was getting more and more revolutionary in my political thought. The Iraq War was starting to heat up by the time I was passing through first couple of semesters of school. And at the same time I was going to college and operating and calling myself Jesse Morton, I was actively participating in radical movements, calling myself Yunus Abdullah Muhammad, one of which is a group located in New York City called the Islamic Thinkers Society. And they're directly affiliated with one of the primary radicalization and recruitment agencies in the United Kingdom, which is really notorious due to the recent arrest of their chief imam, Anjem Chowdhury. They're a movement that was really outspoken at this period of time. And we had direct connections with them. So I started to learn more and more, and I started to climb the ranks inside of that organization. All the while I was functioning as a student, I was getting certifications in New York State for substance abuse counseling, mental health counseling, family counseling, and was working as a social service provider. Then I got a college scholarship to Columbia. I started Revolution Muslim, my own entity, upon the release of my imam from jail in the United Kingdom, Abdullah Faisal.
And, just a note, he was the mentor of one of the 2005 London suicide bombers.
Yes, he had direct connections with more than one of them, but a very heavy influence on Jermaine Lindsay. In fact, when the 7/7, two of the 7/7 bombers went to Pakistan to seek out links to Al-Qaeda, the recruiter for Al-Qaeda, a former British nationalist, vouched for them due to their sound knowledge, and he verified their sound knowledge based upon their contact with people like Abdullah Faisal, and Abdullah Faisal primarily. So, yeah. He was responsible for a large number of individual radicalization situations in the UK while he was there, and was ultimately incarcerated for communication of threats, the same charge I would later be incarcerated for.
So your group, Revolution Muslim, that you founded, tell us, it became this place which a lot of jihadis found great appeal and inspiration from. I mean, Jihadi Jane, the woman who's so-called Jihadi Jane, a couple of them from Massachusetts, Tariq Mahana, Rezwan Firdaus, we'll talk about them in a minute. But what exactly did you do through Revolution Muslim that proved to be such an effective, recruiting area or tool for Al-Qaeda?
Well, up until the point where Revolution Muslim started, I don't think that any organization or individual had unabashedly promoted Al-Qaeda's ideology in the United States. The idea up until that point was that the American Muslim community had some sort of exceptionalism, the idea that because the socioeconomic variables and things of that nature, assimilation and et cetera, made them immune from radicalization, and particularly radicalization into violent extremism. And part of that was because we hadn't yet seen or realized that the primary threat was homegrown violent extremists, or what we tend to call lone wolves. So what Revolution Muslim did was it put together a very unique cluster at its core of an effective means of conveying Al-Qaeda's ideology. We had connection to a charismatic imam, Abdullah Faisal, who gave us religious legitimacy. And I, with my secular education and my knowledge of foreign policy and politics, was able to take his message, politicize it, and frame it in an effective way. And then my other associate, Yusuf al-Khattab, a Jewish convert that lived in Israel and then converted to Islam while practicing Orthodox Judaism, left and moved to Palestine, and then had made his way back to the United States. He already had previous connections with the jihadist network in Europe and in the English-speaking world directly. So I think that we combined and synthesized to make a very effective radicalization or recruitment agency, what's also known as a gateway organization, taking individuals from a stage of radicalization and ushering them along to a pathway towards violent extremism. Like if we look at, for example, the way that ideas spread. And think of Malcolm Gladwell's book, classical work, The Tipping Point, where he talks about three primary individuals. He says that ideas spread like viruses do, and that they rely on people with a very select set of social gifts. So he talks about connectors, mavens, and salesmen. So Sheikh Faisal was essentially a salesman. He could sell you the religious message, and I was a maven. A maven is an individual who disseminates information. So I could take Sheikh Faisal or Abdullah Faisal's message, and I could frame it in a way that was appropriate for current events. Yusuf, with his connections, was a connector. And so when we were all together, we formed quickly, almost overnight, we formulated a hub, if you will, inside of the jihadist, the English-speaking, particularly jihadist community. And we were able to give original output. We also engaged in street or in-person outreach, which made it look like we were speaking truth in an arena where everyone else was afraid to do so.
And this is right here in the United States, right?
This is in New York City, yes, for the most part.
So let me ask you, I mean, you told the New York Times a while ago that basically one of the things that you did so effectively was you would go to the maximum extent allowed by the First Amendment. You weren't necessarily inciting violence, but you were creating controversy that attracted the attention of these young people. And then you would present them with some, I don't know if I'm summarizing this appropriately, but an unbending version of Islam. And then you would tell these young people, like, you have to reject Muslim rulers around the world because the one true and only lawgiver is God. So therefore you can, you know, defy actual Muslim leaders. And you would also, through revolution, Muslim cut off young people from friends and family. And once you'd been able to do this all online, I mean, did you then specifically direct them to jihadist acts?
Well, I mean, of course, if you're operating in the public arena, there would be a guaranteed route to prison where you're able to say, hey, you could reach out to this individual and conduct an operation. Of course, we are under close scrutiny of law enforcement, and we're aware of that. We functioned as a gateway on to bigger and better things, if you will. And so we employed very common. I mean, if you look at the curriculum of texts that were found in the Abbottabad raids, the raids that Osama bin Laden was killed in, and you look at his reading list, there's a document in there that talks about the very same principles that we utilized. This idea that Allah is the only legislator and that every individual Muslim is obligated to believe in Sharia law and to work to establish Sharia law, and then to talk about the caliphate and the missing component of the caliphate in the Muslim world being responsible for all of what we portrayed to be colonialism and then neo-colonialism or neo-imperialism under the United States post-World War II arena. You could take this concept that real Muslims must believe in what we called Tawhid al-Hakimiyyah. You could connect it to this other concept, kufr bitaghut, that you have to reject all false gods. And then under that false gods or that idol-worshipping concept, include the one who rules by other than what Allah has revealed to justify the revolutionary tendencies of jihadist groups. From there, you incorporate a principle called al-wala wal-bara, which is essentially that your love and your allegiance and your identity belongs to the Muslims, and your hatred and your disavowal of everything other than the Muslims is required in order for you to be a true believer. So it was a very strict, as you said, interpretation, a fundamentalist interpretation. However, that only takes you to a certain point. When you're mesmerized alongside of that by current events articles, when you're inserted into chat rooms online. Back then it was Web 2.0. I mean, Facebook was relatively nascent. YouTube was the platform that we used alongside with an online discussion room called PalTalk. And you were immediately inundated in the same way that children or youth today go on to Facebook and befriend one jihadist and are soon inundated with friend requests from 50, then 100, then 150. And soon their entire friends list is posting every day about ISIS and groups like them. That was the same way that we were able to perform. Once an individual gained affinity for our movement, they were immediately exposed to constant lectures online. We also operated in person and in group, which is an important distinction to make, because a lot of times we think that radicalization today happens solely online. It wasn't the case then, and it's not the case now.
Well,
our in-group.
Jesse, I'm sorry to interrupt. I do need to jump in here because I'm conscious of conscientious of the time here.
Yeah.
Because you were, very successful at what you were doing with Revolution Muslim. And we mentioned a couple of the more notorious names of people who were radicalized through your group and those efforts. So I'm wondering, though, how is it, if you could just briefly tell us, it was through your first prison sentence that you were initially radicalized. You then later on were arrested again in 2011, the moment that we started off our conversation with, and you were de-radicalized in your second time in prison. I mean, very briefly tell us, how did that happen, and how can people listening today feel confident that you have been truly de-radicalized?
Well, to make a long story short, ultimately an individual on Revolution Muslim posted a threat against the South Park writers for portraying the Prophet Muhammad. Immediately after that threat, I joined the conspiracy, so to say, by promoting the same ideas that the people that portrayed the Prophet Muhammad should be killed. That controversy sparked international controversy. And what happened was, a woman started Everybody Draw Muhammad Day out in Seattle. Anwar al-Awlaki responded with the first edition of Inspire, which is al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula's English language magazine, a magazine that we started when his associate Samir Khan was here, through what we called Jihad Recollections. Pakistan shut down Facebook. I could go on and on. Ultimately, I ran to Morocco, to Casablanca, where I lived for about a year and several months before the U.S. government decided to issue a criminal complaint against me. While living in Morocco, I taught English and I interacted with the Arab millennial youth, and it really started me off on a path of sort of self-reflection, because I realized that the utopic and, in fact, today I can say totalitarian state that I advocated for was something that none of the youth in the Arab world really essentially had wanted anything to do with. And we engaged in very interesting conversations, including about U.S. foreign policy, about democracy, about liberalism. And so as a consequence of that, it sort of eradicated that black and white worldview, or it was an initial step towards doing so. It was a fascinating experience. And when the criminal complaint was posted online, already the propaganda of al-Qaeda was starting to fall flat. Osama bin Laden was killed about 2 weeks before I was arrested in Morocco in a Casablanca street. And during my 5 months in Moroccan jail, waiting for the United States to come and get me, I had an opportunity to interact with both jihadists from Morocco and then more individuals that were maybe older, but also agreed with the sentiment of the Arab millennial population. So change is not something that happens overnight. It is a process. When the United States government picked me up in a private jet to fly me back to the United States, I had an interaction with a law enforcement agent who asked me if I wanted to be called Jesse Morton or Yunus Abdullah Muhammad. And by the time they came to pick me up, awkwardly, I answered Jesse Morton. And that sort of shook me. The ride home, I realized a little bit that they agreed with a lot of my complaints about things like the Iraq War and things of this nature. So again, the black and white worldview is shattering.
Yeah.
Then when I was in prison, I was removed from the jihadist contacts, and that was very healthy. I was put in solitary confinement, which entails 23 hours of lockdown per day, 1 hour out of the cell. However, there was a very nice third shift guard that didn't necessarily believe that that was an appropriate means of detention. And she would take me to the law library at night and let me stay for her entire shift, her entire 10-hour shift, 4 days a week. And it was at that time that I started to research my case. I started to research the history of free expression in the United States, which I found fascinating. And I also used the jailhouse library to start to read. And instead of read about fundamentalist Islam, I found myself reading the Encyclopedia Britannica's Great Books of the Western World.
Huh.
Long story short, I was fascinated by John Locke. I was fascinated by the Enlightenment thinkers. And I was fascinated particularly by the founding fathers of America, especially Thomas Paine and Alexander Hamilton. When the FBI came to meet with me after I took a plea bargain, conversations ensued that allowed me to establish trust with, in particular, with a female FBI agent. Yeah. I found her fascinating. She was a very good-hearted woman, and over time, I agreed to cooperate. I cooperated while I was in prison, and I was released after 3.5 years, having been originally sentenced to 11 and a half.
Well, we are flat out of time here, Jesse, but I just want to, I mean, if you could briefly tell us, what does the arc of your story suggest about where nations, the United States in particular, should be focusing its efforts when it comes to trying to interrupt the path that many young people are similarly taking to the one you did, how to interrupt radicalization?
Well, that's a very long and complicated question, but in short, I will say that we should really concentrate on realizing that at the core of the issue, it's a battle for ideas. And the only way you can win a battle for ideas is if your rhetoric matches your practice. And I think that we need to also take a step back and look at how it's not just about who the terrorists are, but it's also about who we are. And I think that there are important principles that can be gleaned from my de-radicalization that can be applied in the realm of counterterrorism strategy and making counterterrorism strategy more holistic. So I think there's a lot that we can do, and I think we are improving. And I'm very hopeful that my role at George Washington University's program on extremism will help me to contribute to that and at the same time make amends for who I once was.
Well, Jesse Morton is a research fellow at George Washington University's program on extremism, as he said. He served time in prison for being a former recruiter for Al-Qaeda through the website Revolution Muslim. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.